up, but we don't have to sit here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. I'm going to push that we adjourn this meeting at the latest at 1:15. There's other meetings running, like the Ethics Committee. What we're actually dealing with today is history, referring to the annual reports, except for the international agreements that was referred to us just recently. Secretary, are there any apologies? No apologies. I got hold of Prince Honorable Zulu in the passage. He says he's on his way here. And there were members attending the meeting on the program of the NCOP, chaired by Houseperson Honorable Mashlangu. Honorable members, we are dealing with the report on the financial statements of the Accounting Standards Board for the year 2010-2011, as well as a report of the independent auditors on the financial statements and performance information regarding that financial year. We've got members here from the board. I'm going to ask them, welcome again, that you introduce yourself. The presentation of the members, yes, do you have it? Is this document? That we zoom into it and that you speak to it because it's history. I already engaged with the whip of the National Assembly's Committee on Finance that in future we deal with this in the year that this report are tabled in Parliament and not a year after that in the NCOP. We've got to do things differently, as the Minister of Finance tells us to do, so that we deal with this in the same year, starting in this 2012 year, and be on the ball in terms of joint meetings. And Fridays are set aside by Parliament for joint meetings. So I just want to inform you as well, and the honourable members, welcome again. Over to you. It's now 20 to 10. I'll give you time until 20 past 10. Do you
thank
need
you.
More?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There were research documents circulated. So there are issues highlighted, so please zoom into that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I need that long because I've decided that, based on our earlier discussions, to reduce the presentation to try and highlight some of the issues that are of interest to you. And I don't need to tell you that we fall within the National Treasury vote under the Minister of Finance, and we work closely with the Accountant General and with the Office of the Auditor General. Our key responsibilities is to set standards of generally recognized accounting practice for all spheres of government, and that's where I'll focus my presentation on. Those are the functions that are set out in Chapter 11 of the Public Finance Management Act, so I won't go into that in too much detail. But what we do is we set standards for departments. Departments are still on the modified cash basis, and that reporting framework is determined by the Accountant General. That's both national and provincial departments. The trading entities are going onto our standards from 1 April 2013. All public entities are on standards of GRAP since 2009 already, and so are the constitutional entities, or institutions. Municipalities and their entities started in 2008, and they should be fully compliant by 30 June 2012. And then some of the Parliament has moved to standards of GRAP, and some of the legislatures have also moved, but it's all pending the review of the Public Finance Act of Parliament and the amendments as a result of the constitutional challenge of that legislation. The only exception will be government business enterprises. At the moment, the Treasury regulations require them to use statements of GARP, which is the private sector standards. Those standards are being withdrawn with the establishment of the Financial Review Committee, who will be who have adopted IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, for the private sector as a result of the implementation of the new Companies Act. Now, as a consequence of the withdrawal of statements of GOB, we have issued a guideline at the moment saying that those that are on statements of GOB should continue with that, and those like the major public entities, Eskom, Denel, and those, should continue with IFRS because that's what they initially adopted with consent from the Accountant General. But that we are doing research in this regard by discussing or analysing the needs of the users of financial statements. And based on that, we will make a determination on whether they should stay on IFRS or move to standards of generally recognised accounting practice. We have a new board that was appointed on the 1st of March 2010, and we're Jack, is the chairman of the board. He was a member of the board before and was on the management committee as well during the period of the financials that are under discussion today. I'm quickly going through this because I really only want to talk to you about the key issues of our of what we do. Our standards, we set the standards, and this is often, this slide illustrates a confusion that often occurs in that because we set the standards, preparers and auditors and a wide range of groups think we can also determine when it should be implemented, when, if there are issues of interpretation, if there are differences between auditors and preparers, that we can resolve it. But this slide clearly sets out, we, in terms of the Act, are supposed to set the standards. The Minister determines the implementation date for that standard. The auditors, again, audit against those standards. And National Treasury, and particularly the Accountant General, is responsible for the implementation of those standards. And we all work closely together. In fact, after each board meeting, we have a trilateral meeting with the Accountant General and the Auditor General, where we discuss issues of common concern and issues to that can assist in smooth implementation and reduced audit qualifications. But ultimately, the ASB has got a very small role to play in all of that. How do we set standards? I'm not going to go through the detail other than to highlight on this class, this slide, that it's quite a lengthy process. Some of the standards that we've developed have taken 5 years. Some are developed and issued all in 1 year. And each of those stages are a consultation. There's a consultation process, public consultation process, notices published in the Government Gazette, workshops, roundtables, and all of those kinds of things to get input from the actual preparers, so that their views are heard and we get the practical issues of in making sure the standards are implementable. The one stage that we haven't done yet is the post-implementation reviews, and that's something that we will be looking at in the next year on how we can do it and how best how to get the best results from that post-implementation reviews. Now that the municipalities would have completed the implementation process, we can actually learn some lessons from their experience and see if there are anything we can do to assist in clarification of the standards, particularly before the national and provincial departments start implementing. To date, we've developed a core set of standards. That core set was agreed with the Minister of Finance at that time. That's in 2002. That was Minister Trevor Manuel. And now that we have got a core set of standards, our work program is really focused on the gaps where there are no international standards or national standards, and also based on feedback from stakeholders, from preparers, improve the information that they get and make to enable them to make decisions. And so it's really the priorities that are determined both by the Office of the Accountant General and by the Auditor General. And then obviously we monitor international developments and we try and coordinate our work with the international program so that we don't reinvent the wheel. So far, as I've said, all the national provincial agencies, the parliament and the provincial legislatures and the municipalities have adopted. But national and provincial departments are still on modified cash, and their transition will be determined by the completion of the integrated financial management systems that are currently being developed in partnership with the Department of Public Services and Administration and CETA. So far we've issued 32 standards that have been approved by the board. We've issued 32 standards. Five of those standards are awaiting approval by the Minister of Finance. We've also issued 16 interpretations of those standards, one guideline on public-private partnerships, and 9 directives. The directives are issued to focus on specific types of entities and the transition from the existing accounting basis to the standards of GRAP. And that's in response to the requirement in the legislation that we take into account the capacity of the entities to adopt the standards. I think that's broadly what we've done to date. We're currently working on specific public sector specific financial instruments. Those are receivables and payables that arise from legislation. We're also working, we're doing the research on government business enterprises. We are issuing, or at the board meeting on Monday, the board approved a discussion paper on principal and agent activities in entities, because municipalities are often required to do work on behalf of national or provincial departments, and it's difficult to determine whether they're doing it as an agent or whether they're doing it in their own capacity. We're also working on living and other naturally occurring resources. That's really the stuff in the national parks and places like that. We're reviewing the guideline on public-private partnerships, and as I've mentioned already, we're starting the post-implementation reviews to assess the effectiveness of the standards and how they've been implemented. Internationally, we're working on the conceptual framework that underpins the standards. We're working on financial statement discussion and analysis. And I think something that is of interest to everybody, or should be of interest to everybody, is long-term sustainability of an entity's finances. And if we look at newspaper reports about the number of municipalities that are not sustainable, their finances are not sustainable, this is really talking to that project. We're also working on service performance information, and we're doing a review of government financial statistics, the information used by the International Monetary Fund and the United Nations, to make sure that these statistics talk to our financial information. That's it. Thank you.
Anything you want to add?
So I guess the key consideration that we're focusing on is the post-implementation review, so that when government departments and provincial departments move over to the accrual basis of accounting, we can be able to take some of the lessons learned with the adoption of the municipalities and so forth. And the second thing is how we make sure that the IFMS, which is the Integrated Financial Management System that is worked on by the Treasury, is going to make sure that it embeds the accounting standards, that it makes it easier for the rollout now when the national departments and the provincial departments come on board. So those are the two major issues that we're working with now.
That's issues we must do oversight on. Other members, thank you for your presentation. Accounting and auditing goes hand in hand. Do you want first to deliberate on this submission, or basis on that as well. Yeah. Honorable members, it's this document. You have it in front of you. Please note your questions regarding the first presentation.
And then if there's time, I'll take any questions. The strategic focus of the RBA is to protect the financial interests of the public by ensuring that only suitably qualified individuals are admitted to the auditing profession and that registered auditors deliver services of the highest quality and adhere to the highest ethical standards. And if that wasn't the situation, then the public, internationally and locally, wouldn't have confidence in our financial markets. And as such, it is quite important that the profession plays quite an important role in ensuring that we have the confidence in our financial markets so that internationally investors feel comfortable to invest their money in South Africa. As I already mentioned, we protect the financial interests of the public, and together with auditors, we must ensure that they deliver auditors of the highest quality. The role of the RBA is twofold. Firstly, we set the standards for auditing, so we're a standard setter. In some countries, the standard setting is not with the regulator. And secondly, we are the regulator. So those two functions are combined under the independent regulatory board for auditors. Our objectives then flow from those two high-level, from that mandate. And just to break it down a little bit further, we are responsible for developing and maintaining auditing and ethical standards which are internationally comparable. So our Act specifically says that we cannot develop our own local standards. We could in addition to the international standards, but it must be comparable to international standards. We must provide a framework for the education and training of properly qualified auditors, as well as their ongoing competence, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the board exam, and we set the final paper for the board exam for candidates to qualify as chartered accountants, and then they may register with the RBA as auditors. The registration of auditors who meet the registration requirements, it is a huge responsibility of the RBA to ensure that only suitably qualified people are sent out in the market to audit financial statements. If that wasn't the case, then there will be no reliance on the audit report that they produce on those financial statements. We monitor compliance with reportable irregularities and anti-money laundering. In 2006, the then Minister of Finance felt that there should be additional measures to try and curb white-collar crime in South Africa. And therefore, a section which is very unique to South Africa has been introduced to require auditors to report any reportable irregularities to the RBA that they pick up in an audit, and we will then report that to any relevant regulator, including SARS, the FSB, the JSE, and sometimes you have to report it to the police if there's any criminal offense at a client. But that was intended to at least reduce white-collar crime in South Africa. We also, in terms of the anti-money laundering legislation, Financial Intelligence Center Act, the RBA is designated as a supervisory body. What that means is that the FIC relies on the RBA to assist them in monitoring compliance with anti-money laundering legislation when it comes to auditors. So instead of them inspecting auditors, they require us to keep an eye on that. We monitor registered auditors' compliance with professional standards, and again, we are one of the few professions where we actually inspect what our professional members do. So we have about 12 inspectors that go out every day and inspect the 4,500 auditors over a cycle of 3 or 6 years, depending on whether the clients that they audit are high risk or not. And then if there's any auditors that are not complying with the standards or we receive any complaint against an auditor, we have an investigations process, and if the auditor is investigations committee refers that to disciplinary committee, the disciplinary committee will decide whether the auditor is guilty or not, and the sanctions, they range from a fine to being struck from the register. The highlights were that reported in the 2011 financial year was our achievement of number one position out of the 139 countries for our auditing standards, and what we thought was a good achievement was the fact that it was the second year that we achieved that in 2 years' time. We issued our code of professional conduct for registered auditors on 1 January 2011. We've always had a code of conduct, but the board felt that we need to tighten up on that code to regulate auditors even tighter, and we've therefore issued a much stricter code in January 2011. The European Union also approved the RBA as a regulator which is equivalent to the best in the world. What that means is that internationally other regulators look at how auditors in a country are regulated. If they are comfortable that they are properly regulated, then they won't come into South Africa and inspect those auditors. So, for example, if an auditor audits a subsidiary of a company listed in Europe or in America, then those regulators are supposed to come and ensure that they comply with the standards. But if they're comfortable that the local regulator is strong enough, then they will accept and approve the RBA, and therefore they won't come into South Africa to perform inspections. And this has happened with the European Union. We are still working with the United States of America to also obtain such accreditation and approval, but they are far more strict when it comes to the funding of the organization. The RBA was also approved last year for registered auditors to provide broad-based black economic empowerment verification services. And since then, the DTI has progressed with their legislation to allow the RBA to also register non-auditors to perform black economic empowerment services, with the ultimate aim of the RBA becoming the regulator of the BEE verification industry. And our legislation is in the process of being amended to accommodate that. If I can just briefly touch on the highlights in the financial statements. If we look at the income statement, the statement of financial performance first, and I can just try and explain some of the areas where there's been some movement, some big movement. On the revenue side, you'll see that our income increased from 60 to 67 million rand. We operate on a budget of about 70 million rand a year, and generally that comes one-third from National Treasury, one-third from auditors' registration fees, and a third from performing inspections. However, it is quite important for the RBA to be seen as independent that our funding doesn't come from auditors at all, and we're busy developing a new funding model to be approved by the Minister whereby we don't get any money from auditors anymore because it might be perceived to affect the independence of the regulator. So on the revenue side, the increase of about 7 million includes a 6 million rand additional amount that we received from National Treasury, because in 2010 we deregistered for VAT, and therefore all our VAT expenses had to be covered, and we requested an additional 6 million rand from government, and that we've received an increase in our annual revenue to about 67 million. You'll also note that on the bottom line, the surplus for the period is 9 million rand, which appears high, but obviously it includes, first of all, the 6 million additional revenue that we received from government. And also, you might recall that the minister at the time requested all the public entities to try and save on cost as far as they can. And when we compared our budget to the actual expenses that we incurred, we saved on about 4 million for that year. And together with the 6 million gives you the approximate 9 million rand. On the statement of changes in net assets, if I can explain the 28 million total net assets, that consists of, first of all, the accumulated surplus, which I've just discussed, of about 10 million, and then there's an amount of 19 million, which are really cash funded reserves. Those are three reserves maintained by the RBA, and they are meant to be funded by cash. At the moment, we don't have sufficient cash to actually fund those reserves, because in terms of accounting principles, those reserves must be represented by cash. If I can just explain what they are. The first one is the 10 million rand was our old building that we sold, and the Minister of Finance then said that we should invest that money. It's currently invested with the Reserve Bank, and we can't touch that money. We can only use the interest from that money to further transformation in the profession. So that's the 10 million. And then we have to build up an education fund to help students with the exams, etc., and to become chartered accountants and auditors. And we have a disciplinary fund in case there's a huge disciplinary case that might require quite a lot of money. And there is one such case coming up at the end of December where we might use the funds if we run out of our budget for disciplinary hearings. So those are the three funds, and 19 million of our cash reserves is represented by funds, and only 9 million is the accumulated surplus, of which only 3.8 million is represented in cash. And that 3.8 million we require to just run the business on a daily basis. On the statement of financial position, if we look at the intangible assets, that's really just some software or it was a business. also try to break down our income so that you can see how we achieve or how we arrive at the total income. As I mentioned earlier, about a third comes from government, and this year specifically there was an extra $6 million. Some comes from inspection fees, and it's very important that we do not charge for inspections going forward, because we cannot inspect an auditor and then take money from them, and that is why we're trying to change our funding model. RA contributions consist of not only the registration fees of auditors, but also the training contracts of potential auditors or article clerks. We get income from that as well. That has decreased slightly in 2011 because we had fewer auditors registered with us. With the new Companies Act, there was uncertainty about whether audits will still be relevant, and because of the introduction of the independent review, which is an alternate assurance service. And so some auditors decided to deregister, and fewer students decided to take up articles because they weren't sure whether they will still be auditing. But I think the numbers are stabilizing, and I think the profession should be okay. On the report of the Auditor General, we've just summarized both years, 2010 and 2011. We've received a clean report on the financial statements for both years. We've received a clean report on the predetermined objectives, as well as the compliance of laws and regulations. And on the internal control, there were no significant deficiencies for both years. On the performance information, I'll really just cover those areas that we haven't achieved and trying to explain why we haven't achieved those. The first one is the issuance of the Code of Professional Conduct that I mentioned earlier, that we've been developing that over 2 years. It's very difficult to have a plan of standards that you'll issue if you don't know what the needs will be out there. So what we do is we put together a program, a work program, of what the requirements might be to auditors for guidance on ethics standards, and we do the same for auditing standards. But on the ethics side, we hadn't put the program together by the time or by the year end, and so we couldn't measure the 75% achievement against that plan. We don't say that we'll issue 10 standards and then we only issued 5 or 6. We look at the work program and we have to sign off on how much of that work program has been achieved, but at the end of the financial year, that program wasn't yet established. On the reportable irregularities, which I explained earlier, auditors report to us if there's a reportable irregularity, and they have 30 days, they send us a first report, and then they have 30 days in which they must send a second report to confirm whether their suspicion of the irregularity was right or wrong. Now, our target is to close all files after we receive the second report. We want to close them within 40 days, and we'd like to achieve 90% of closing them within 40 days. We've achieved 66% of those. 22% of the files were over 40 days, were closed after 40 days, and that is because auditors don't always submit the files on time. We have to follow up with them. And then 12% of the reports were not received as yet. So that's the reason why we didn't achieve the 40-day target that we set ourselves. Education, we've achieved everything. If I can go to inspections, I mentioned earlier that the RBA is a supervisory body in terms of the Financial Intelligence Center Act, and we are supposed to supervise accountable institutions. Accountable institutions are just those people that provide financial services, and they are the ones that need to be monitored. And at the end of this period, we were still busy putting together the list of accountable institutions. Even now, we are talking to the Financial Services Board because they have to supervise all financial service providers. And if they're also auditors, it means that we must also supervise them. And we're busy with an MOA to decide who shall take the lead in supervising them so there's no duplication. But at this point in time, we were still busy compiling a list of accountable institutions. The idea is that eventually we can compare our list to the Financial Services Board's list and see whether it's complete and whether all auditors have declared whether they are accountable institutions. On the legal cases, we set ourselves a target to complete 80% of complaints that we received we'd like to close in. I apologize, that shouldn't be 18 months, it should be 12 months in our report. We were hoping to close them within 12 months, but because cases become protracted, evidence isn't available, we didn't actually achieve that. We only managed to achieve 66% of that 80%, and because we realized that our target setting was unrealistic. We've changed that now to say we'd like to close 80% within an 18-month period, and I think that's where the error came in. It was 12 months. We've now increased that to 18 months, but that is the reason we haven't achieved them. Sometimes the cases drag on, and instead of finishing a case in a week or in a couple of months, it just takes a little bit longer. On the stakeholder relationship, we agreed to have a stakeholder and a communication plan. We've decided to continue with the current plan that we have. We didn't develop a new plan because the RBA embarked on a whole branding exercise, and we've developed a new branding strategy to brand the registered auditor and the RBA. Earlier I mentioned that we were concerned that we were losing registration of auditors. It's a high-risk profession, and because of the Companies Act, a lot of auditors are deciding to do independent reviews, which they are also now allowed to do. And so the board realized that we need to actually sell our brand a little bit more, and that branding strategy has just been completed, and therefore from the branding strategy we will complete a new stakeholder plan and a new communication plan. But at this point in time, at the end of the year, we didn't, because we knew that it would change going forward. The registration of auditors, we set ourselves a target every auditor has to annually renew the registration, and we set ourselves a target to register them by a certain date. And again, there we haven't achieved that with every registration. If we give ourselves so many days, some of them we did go slightly over because of some anything that could happen that could delay the process. So we didn't quite achieve that. But hopefully we've changed the management in that department, and we've also improved the processes so that we can meet that target in future. We didn't change the target. We'll just work harder to achieve that target. On the IT systems, we were supposed to have an IT strategy and plan and implement it. We haven't achieved that because we first tried to stabilize our database. And earlier I talked about the $3 million investment that we made in a new workflow system. And because we were busy implementing that new workflow system, we didn't actually have our IT strategy. We didn't achieve that target because we focused on first implementing the database and the workflow system, and therefore the overall IT strategy, which includes the workflow system, have been delayed. Mr. Chairman and members, I hope that I've highlighted any issues or important information that you picked up in our annual report, of which you'd have a copy, and then I thank you.
Mr. Gallis, for your presentation to both institutions, all the members, there you've got it, both of them received an unqualified report, audit report from the Auditor General without any findings. So we are blessed with that. All the members, starting with the ASB, I'm from the Northern Cape, and there's one sentence that is bit of a concern to me, referring to challenges that you experience, that the ASB has not met yet with four provinces, as mentioned in the report, namely Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northwest, and then my province, Northern Cape. Now, it's part of this committee's work to come up with solutions to take issues forward, to address it and to solve it, and I'm from the Northern Cape, so I'll engage with my province. If that hasn't happened, why? And secondly, to arrange such a meeting that you get into the Northern Cape. I'll do that today after this meeting. So if you can elaborate on that, all the members, you can put your questions. Let me just note it. Honorable Monsisi, Honorable Leash, sorry, Honorable Mashile, and Honorable Chani. Thank you, in that order. And after that, you can address your questions to the other board.
Chairperson, I welcome the briefing by the two structures. My question, Chairperson, it hinges on the South Africa as a developmental state. We are a developing economy, and the type of accounting standards that are being implemented, it seems to me that they are far advanced for the type of economy that our country is still in. Let me give an example of what I'm saying here. Firstly, this report is for the ASB. Now, the ASB says we are talking of a post-implementing review, which is a review that they still have to conduct with respect to whether the implemented standards, the standards are being implementable, and whatever problems are encountered in the implementation of standards, so that they can be able to adjust here and there. Now, firstly, my question would be, in terms of their assessment, local government, for instance, how would you rate local government in the implementation of CRAP, for instance? That is one. And then two, the ratings on the national departments. Chairperson, let me go to the RBA. Chairperson, I just want to understand in terms of the experience and analysis that you conduct, how friendly are the accounting practices that we implement in South Africa for small business? Somebody acquires a tender or some work to do and so on and so on. Whether it's a mine that the person has bought and so on, or construction company, the person has to be audited. The company has to be audited. Now, I would like to know how friendly this system is to small business. Because one other thing would be whether this BEE development process that is taking place, you have the leadership of these personnel in these companies being trained in terms of the practice that is being utilized in auditing. And then, for them to be able to identify a fraudulent communication across to innocent aspiring business people in order to get legitimate assistance. So I'm interested also in the process that you utilize in publicizing yourselves and legitimate professional personnel. And on page 4, the objective is to develop and then maintaining auditing and ethical standards which are internationally comparable. Now my question is, what is wrong in saying which are compatible with the development of our economy, to be able to strike a balance? And then, I appreciate, Jefferson, I really appreciate the fact that we are number one out of 139 countries. It's very good, but I understand also that we are trying to do this in order to attract the international community to see that we are not corrupt and their money will be safe and when they invest and so on. But in relation to the efforts that we take to be international in terms of accounting practices, does it ipso facto relate to huge investments in South Africa? Do we really attract foreign direct investment in South Africa as a result of our accounting practices, which are acclaimed internationally? Thank you.
I think the objective for financial stability can lead to the attraction of investors. Honorable Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, to the Accountant Standards Board. Thank you to both teams for being here this morning with us. Limited number of questions. In terms of the drafting of standards, there's some questions on figures which I'll get to, but being, I would assume, the primary role of the organization, one of the things that really gets me is the provision of depreciation in an organization which pays no tax and has no reason to show as an expense and a depreciation over an extended period, instead of simply writing off the asset on acquisition, on a payments and receipts and payments basis, which is essentially what municipalities are. And so we spend a lot of time looking at things, and people don't pick out that depreciation is not a real expense for that year. It could be 10 times that amount of cash paid out for assets. And so the bottom line of those financials is actually a misrepresentation of the true state of affairs to the majority of counselors out there who have no accounting background. And surely the standards that you're setting should be making, and it builds a little bit on Honourable Onesie, the standards should be not necessarily international, but make it possible for the people who actually do the oversight and run the institution, whether it's a municipality, even the province or a national department, to really understand what they're looking at. Very few people actually understand any of these financial statements. The annual report, there's a whole lot of verbiage in it, and I'll get to that one has so many pictures and all sorts of things which are totally irrelevant. I don't need to know what they look like, but it just costs, the printing world loves it. So it's just, you know, is there any view with your board that you need to simplify or make it more relevant, and perhaps ignore international of 744,000. So the surrender is getting less. Now that either means that you're finding ways to spend the money, and perhaps we should look more closely at your expenses and reduce the amount allocated, or was there a kind of build-up in the organization, capacity building and so on? If you can give me some idea there. Your payroll-related accruals is a dramatic change from 2010 to 2011. Now, that might link into my question about the recovery to National Treasury. In other words, your staffing complement built up. So thank you very much to the Accounting Standards Board. Now, in terms of you guys, I've made a comment about your annual report. It's double the thickness. It has all these pictures and stuff in here. And, I mean, even the picture of Honorable Praveen Gordon. Can you really justify putting all that into an annual report? And the costs and the printing and all the rest of it. I think you'll be hard-pressed to convince me of that, but you're welcome to try if you wish to, but that's my view. You talked about this 10 million rand that is invested with the Reserve Bank. I assume it's the proceeds of this old building. That's what I heard you say. But I'm astounded that you're now paying 4.3 million rand a year in leases. What was the justification for selling a building for 10 million rand and then over a two-year period losing all that money again? Obviously, when you own a building, there's maintenance and rates, and so that's a very simplified kind of thing. But just give me some comfort as to why we would sell a building and then enter into a lease agreement of 4.3 million. And I trust it's not in any way related to the police kind of buildings that are under discussion and cause many resignations and dismissals. I assume not, seeing as you've got a clean audit. Your trade and other receivables from exchange transactions seems to me to be quite high, and then on note 10 you give a breakdown of it. So majority of that is inspections, but it still seems quite high. What is the collection? Are you running into 120, 180 days, or so these inspections, are they're with members of the profession, I would assume, or maybe not, maybe they're just general inspections elsewhere, but in other words, the client there is one of your own members. And I would be surprised then that anything went over 30 days. I assume your credit terms are 30 days or less. So some comfort there. Who do you give loans to? Your loan book has increased from 120,000 to 160,000. Are these staff loans? Written off bad debts, 230,000 in 2010, 122,000 in 2011. Again, I asked a similar kind of question as I just now about the debtors, in the sense that if your clients are your own members, are your own members going bankrupt that you can't recover fees that you may have charged them? And then just for my point, note 16, I assume that license fees are your membership subscriptions, as we would in the old days have referred to them, and then registration fees are new members coming into the profession. I sometimes get confused why terminology has to be changed in these things. Your board members, you've listed them, you've given their remuneration for each year, but you don't give the number of meetings they attended, which I think has become, I haven't kept up with IFRS or any other standards, long out of the profession, but I've seen many times the number of meetings. It would be interesting to see how many meetings were held, who attended, who didn't, and then get an idea of how that the amount paid to them relates to the amount of work done. Thank you. for putting your own salary there. It's an interesting amount. I won't comment any further than that. In your income statement, the detailed income statement on page 76, which hasn't got a note number. Other expenses are quite high, 1.7 million in 2010, 1.5 million in 2011. When you go down to workman's compensation, 7,280 rand, I'm wondering why such a large amount hasn't been detailed. Then committee expenses have come down by 900,000. What kind of expenses are those? Do they also get paid to board members? So the costs of the board members that are listed in one of the notes I've just quoted, note 26, is this also part of the money going to them for travel and accommodation and so on? What are their committee expenses? I know you do need to be audited. I understand that even the auditor's board needs an audit, but 1.3 million? I mean, how many transactions do you have? Is it justified, such a huge fee? Perhaps I've lost touch with you since I left. But it seems like a huge fee. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that. I'm curious about the new model for funding. I understand the argument about the members not funding their own organization, which then sets the standards for themselves. However, what it ultimately would do would reduce the cost structures for the profession, and that cost structure presumably would be picked up somewhere else, which you're working on some model. Currently the state picks up a large portion of it, and I would anticipate that you won't see a reduction in fees out there as a result of the reduction in costs. In terms of the big picture, I suppose for each firm it's fairly small. But nevertheless, I would see some resistance to paying for someone else's professional status, if you understand what I'm saying. The real issue is I'm curious about the new model, which you haven't told us about. I'm curious to see what is proposed there. The question of the New Companies Act obviously has had an impact. I've seen it in Ladysmith, for instance. The old audit firms are now scrambling for the kind of business that used to be done by accounting offices and so on. So that competition has increased, but unfortunately the overheads and the fee structures just make them uncompetitive to a large extent. And so I would see in small towns like that there's going to be a realignment of the way business is done by your members. And I'm wondering how that's going to fit into the organization, whether you actually are going to lose more members or not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You on the leasing, it's the first time that we interact with this with the board, and the pictures tells us who's working there and what they look like. But there's some advice. Honorable Mashile and then Honorable Chan.
A thanks, Jefferson, and definitely, of course, is that I'm really seeing them for the first time, all of them. I'm not sure because I'm a regular absentee, whether they may have pitched up on those specific days that I was not here, but if I'm still performing in terms of presence, I haven't seen them. So, Chair, and as you have indicated right at the beginning, that really we're dealing with history. It is really a question of those things out of these historical documents that are in front of us that they picked up to be a challenge, and how are they giving question relating to the meetings that could not be done with Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northwest and Northern Cape. Now, as I'm speaking, Chair, I think it will just simply be to check that is it still the same or that situation has improved. And if not, if there's not improved, that some of them may have gone out of the outstanding list. And then what will then be the consequences that we must that must drive us to do something if we have got anything to do to actually deal with that specific thing. Chairperson, the Auditor General in general, he also have a question on the level of compliance, or let me say not compliance, but standards. That standards are generally going down. Commitment by people that are supposed to maintain certain standards or compliance also is going down. And therefore one just wants to know from the two bodies, because it looks like it is in your courts, to play some meaningful role. It may not be 100% responsible, but there is a little bit that you can perform. What is that that you can do to assist? Of course, not disregarding the issue of lack of skills or lack of just warm bodies. I mean, correctly trained warm bodies in some of the small little municipalities, this specific thing takes me to the next question, Chair, that Operation Clean Audit in 2014. I'm raising these questions. I think both organizations or entities can just respond on how it affects them. Operation Clean Audit, what are the chances of us achieving that? You know, I mean, we need to be advised, Chair, whether it is an achievable thing. If it is not an achievable thing, we must be advised early so that then corrective actions can be taken if ever they have to be taken. Because what we have realized is that since we have talked about Operation Clean Audit 2014 or something like that, that they are doing? What is Treasury saying? What is the Accountant General saying? And are there things that they are querying on their work? Are there things that they are awaiting either comment, approval, or whatever from Treasury? Is there any synergy when you produce a standard and then does it get carried and implemented? If not, what are the challenges? And then and those particular standards, like as one would know in accounting, that it takes years to produce a standard. And if it takes years again to implement it, then it may even, by the time that it is implemented, then you may have needed to actually amend or review the standard. And then it becomes irrelevant by the time it is implemented. So it's one just wants to know that operational relationship with Treasury and the Accountant General. I can see that with the Auditor General you are interacting almost on a daily basis, but what about the Accounts General and Treasury on its own to do things with you? And then, Chair, there is another question that I wanted to raise with the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. I think there is a conscious and deliberate use of the word registered auditors continuously. But then now, Chair, we've got a sector, the auditing. Then you talk only about registered auditors. And probably you'll also be talking about the registered accounting practitioners. One of these days we'll be talking about that. But then in February, I think, and the Minister of Finance then complained about these practitioners on non-compliance payment of taxes. And then when we followed it up, and then it was raised and said, no, it's the unregistered, it's not our members. Now the question now is, when you are there as a regulatory body, and then you have got people that are not registered with you, that are changing your sector, how do you deal with that? How are you jealously guarding your territory? Have you adopted a don't care attitude that those that are not our members, then they can just run? overseas things, and the Enrons and whatever and all that, how they actually found themselves in troubles and the rest, and even the even this financial crisis, it happened under the nose of auditors and accountants and all that. But in your experience, how many of the reputable firms that you believed that they know what they are doing, they can be trusted, but then you received a complaint about them, and that complaint was verified, and then what lesson then have you learned out of that? And Chair, the last one is a question that we are boasting that we have been approved and recognized in South Africa by the European Union and other countries as holding high standards, that we can be trusted to do the work on their behalf. And then I suppose that we are taking an inferior position. Now I want to know that when we turn it the other way around, is there any other agency like yours in the other continents and countries that satisfies your requirements, and then you approved them to do the work on your behalf? Are we also regarded as people that we can approve any other institution outside for similar purposes, like we are being treated by the European Union and either the IMF or so? Thanks, Chairperson.
Charlie? Issues that came out in the HE's report, especially when we deal with the departments but specific municipalities to the ASB, is the poor quality of financial statements. There are specifications in the PFMA and FMA for financial statements to be submitted at a specific date. Yes, departments, municipalities submit it, but then after that it's given back to that municipality or department for the incorrectness of the financial statements. And that's the thing that we will have to address in terms of the program Clean Audit, which is a very serious matter. And this committee, as well as our committee on appropriations, deal with the municipalities. And in some provinces, there were a regression. In some provinces, it was stagnant. There was no improvement. Some departments and municipalities have improved, and there can be interaction in terms of the best practice. The point is that we all work as a collective in terms of the Operation Clean Audit. The other remark I want to make, what role do you play, both entities, in Africa, if we look north of us, to improve the standards of accounting and auditing on our continent? Let the world look at us through another to improve the financial management on our continent. Because when you move abroad, the remarks about Africa are not always so encouraging. And it's our role to get grip on that, to show them that we can do it. South Africa did that. Here's an excellent example. But how do we take this further? You can reply, both of you, and after that, we'll take the international agreements.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm happy to report back that the outreach to stakeholders have been expanded to all the provinces, and this last year we have been in every province. So that list that was in last year's financial statements is no longer an issue of concern. I think the issue of concern for us, however, is the timing of the interaction. We need interaction with preparers and users and auditors of financial statements during the development of the standard. And if you look back at that slide that I had with the circle and the various stages of interaction, we need interaction at that stage and not only when they have to implement the standards. And it is because there are six standards that have to be implemented from 1 April 2012 that we've had interaction at all the provinces. One of the things we did this year was we looked at the standards that have been approved by the Minister of Finance for implementation. And so before the implementation date, we went to every province and had outreach with municipalities to create awareness of what are the requirements of those standards, what do they need to do in advance, so they don't wait until 30 June 2013 when the auditors when the audit has to start to try and achieve compliance with those standards, but that they plan now to achieve compliance with those standards. And so any support that we can receive from any of you with regards to the timing of our interaction, i.e. during the development stage and not at the implementation stage, would be welcomed. I think the next question we had was whether the standards that we're developing are appropriate for developing countries, and how would we rate the implementation both at the local government level and at a national and provincial department level.
And I think there is cognizance that we take when we develop the standards. We say, okay, is the guidance on a particular issue that is available internationally? And then we look at the guidance and tailor make it for the reality on the ground in South Africa so that the user's needs in South Africa are met. And the key litmus test for us is always to say, does this promote accountability? Does the standard promote greater accountability? And secondly, does it facilitate efficient decision making by the people that are accountable? And do we address then the local conditions? And that's the kind of test that we apply, and then we take that through the due process and getting comments. And most of the comments that we get help us to further tailor make the standards to make sure that it meets the requirements of the local conditions, but without compromising the accountability and appropriate decision making by the users. And so when we look at the developmental state, that's in our due process. Those are the issues that are taken into account. And sometimes we do have departures from the international standards for locally based reasons, to say that our legislation and our reality on the ground would not accommodate the international approach, and therefore we will stick with the current local reality. And so when we look at the post-implementation review, and I guess it also ties into the simplification of what is the outcome of these standards? What information do you use that is really usable? And that's part of the focus of our post-implementation, to say from the oversight bodies, from the users, the men on the street, does this really make sense for them? And those are the things that we would be factoring into that review to make sure then how can we be able to provide them with information that will enable their oversight function to be much more better, and also that would allow the resources that are under the use of the people accountable that they would be using this information to make sure that they maximize the use of those resources. So when we look at the user, we'll be looking at the user point of view when we look at the post-implementation review, not only just is it for the preparers to say, is it easy to get this or it's too difficult. assume the second part is in terms of how far the local government and the national department in terms of the implementation. National Treasury has actually segmented the municipalities to say you have your high capacity municipalities, medium and low capacity municipalities. We find that the use of the standards at the high capacity and even the medium capacity municipalities to be much greater, it's better. And at the local, at the low capacity municipalities, we find the lack of skills is a problem. And in terms of, you might have CFOs that might not necessarily even have an accounting degree. And so therefore they would tend to then use consultants to plug in that gap, which is not really sustainable. And hence the key there is how do you improve the capabilities of the preparers at the low capacity municipalities and make sure that at the high capacity and the medium capacity that they maintain that level of expertise, because it's also quite difficult sometimes to retain people, and so when people leave then it can create gaps. So maintaining that level of capacity, then that would be quite critical to be able to meet the objectives of Operation Clean Audit 2014. But with the low capacity municipalities, it might be quite difficult because the kind of skills that need to be embedded on a sustainable basis can take time beyond the 2014. So that's to cover, I guess, the simplification and also the developmental state question.
Thank you. I also just want to add to that and say that accounting standards in themselves are neutral. They don't really, they're not written for a developed economy or an industrialized economy or not. They really are looking at transactions, and the transactions don't really change based on the stage of the economy. And it's interesting that the countries that have adopted the international public sector accounting standards on which our standards are based are the previous communist countries, the countries that were part of Albania, the Serbia, the Croatia, all the countries with the stuns in their names. They are the first implementers of the international public sector accounting standards. And the ones that you expect to be compliant, the Europeans haven't adopted international public sector accounting standards, but they are currently in a investigation process because there is a proposal by the European Union that they should consider adopting those standards. Greece, for example, are on a cash basis; they are not on accrual accounting, and that is what we are aiming to achieve in South Africa: is for everybody to be on accrual accounting. At national government level, we really cannot rate the extent to which they will be able to comply, because they are still using the modified cash basis, which has been developed by the National Treasury. I think in my interaction with some preparers, I do think there are some that are quite capable of moving across and maintaining an unqualified report, audit report, but there are others where there's certainly training needed. And even in the oversight body, for example, at National Treasury of the public entities under its control, the skills of some of the people in that entity, in that department, needs to be upgraded in order to perform effective oversight over the public entities that report to the National Treasury. One of the questions we were asked is why do we depreciate assets and not just expense it? And I think that's one of the big issues on why we believe everybody should be on accrual accounting, because we have spent millions and millions in the past on assets that we are still using, but because they have been expensed, they don't appear on anybody's balance sheet. Nobody takes accountability. Nobody's held accountable for those assets. So when infrastructure isn't delivering the services that are expected of municipalities, for example, It's because those things are not reflected on their financial statements. And yes, maybe when you look at the County Standards Board, where we're mainly performing office work, because most of our work is intellectual capacity rather than delivering a service like a municipality would, it would seem to be appropriate to just expense it. But we are using those assets, and depreciation is meant to be the charge for the use of those assets over its useful life. I mean, there is a theory that depreciation should be sufficient over the period that you're using the assets so that you can replace those assets. That's that cash-backed reserve view that was held in the past. But that's not the case. It cannot be the case in a high inflation environment. The depreciation that you are writing off is never sufficient to replace those existing assets. And that's why in financial statements we have disclosure requirements about fully depreciated assets as well, so that we know that are still in use. In theory, if accounting standards are applied properly, you should never have fully depreciated assets because they're still being used. But unfortunately, theory and practice doesn't always work out the same. And that's why we do post-implementation reviews, to make sure that we've got that the theory and the practice are aligned. I think when we started the Accounting Standards Board, we based our standards on, and we are required in terms of the legislation to use international standards or national standards if there are no international standards. And we decided to base our standards on international public sector accounting standards, but we agreed some principles on when we would make amendments. And one of, only in the last 3 years, I think, have we agreed to add simplification to that process. And so if you look at some of our more recent standards, particularly financial instruments, employee benefits, and the three standards on transfer of functions, we have deviated significantly from the international equivalents of those standards to make them appropriate for the public sector and for the South African environment. And some of the other South African standards that we've developed where there are no international equivalent are now being used by the international board to base these standards on. And we're quite happy that where international standards have been based on our standards, there haven't been any significant deviation from the principles that we've adopted. So yes, one of our objectives is to make it simpler. But size and in the public sector doesn't really dictate a different type of standard that's needed, unlike the private sector. And one of the things we've done is we've compared our standards with the private sector standards for small and medium enterprises to identify all the areas where we can simplify and should simplify. And based on that, we have identified two standards. Borrowing costs, we are now proposing that all borrowing costs are expensed. And we've also discontinued with a standard on assets held for sale because the value of that in the public sector wasn't really appropriate. But that's also what gave rise to the project on post-implementation reviews and simplification. So that's one of the key, pillars on which our standards in future will be based, is making sure that we simplify when it's appropriate. You asked the question about the amounts that we've surrendered. I think initially when we started, the budget of the board was based on having myself as the CEO and then two standard setters and hopefully one or two people that we could train as standard setters. But that never materialized over the long term. And so initially the surrenders were based on our inability to either provide appropriate training within the budget, or finding the appropriate staff at the right time. So most of the surrenders that we've had has been based on staff, savings on staff. However, because we're seven people, of which four of us are qualified chartered accountants, and that's the kind of skill that you need for standard setting, we have found that the increases in salaries for those people have outpaced the increase at which our transfer payment has increased by. It normally increased by about 4.5% in our, or 5% per year, while salaries increase generally by, in that, for those kinds of people, by 7% or more per year. And so any potential saving that we've had in the past, or potential for irregular expenditure or wastage or whatever you want to call it, has been eroded over time because of that mismatch between the increase in our transfer payment and the actual salary bill. And as a result of staff being the key, if we don't have the right staff, we can't set standards. It's as simple as that. And if we lose any one person, at the moment we have four people, if any one of those four people leave this, we are unable to deliver on our performance objectives. So we've agreed with the minister that we will increase our staff complement by two people who will be junior standard setters. We've now been advertising and trying to recruit for those positions for about 18 months and haven't filled those positions. And the minister in the last budget gave us an increase of R1 million so that we could try and attract one position and pay the recruitment costs and all the equipment and things that goes with that position, and then hopefully increase it again in the next year so that we can fund the second position. Making sure that the staff we have are adequately trained and continue to be adequately trained means that we need training money for in the budget for training. And that has been where we've made our savings in the past, because that's really, of all our expenses, the only thing where we can really exercise judgment on whether you send somebody for a training course or not. And unfortunately, we've been using that as the balancing figure in our budget, and that's not sustainable in an environment where you are relying on people. So we've had some discussions with the Treasurer about that, and hopefully that will be resolved in the future. With regards to the payroll provision, that is just the provision for leave pay, and the increase is a function of the increase in salaries and the number of leave days due to the staff. And generally, with our year-end being the 31st of March, lots of people take the leave during the April period when there's a lot of public holidays as well. And that's generally when our provision goes down significantly from what was there at 31 March. I think the challenges for the ASB, I've already started off with that by saying it's consultation with our stakeholders, outreach at the right time, and getting input into the standard setting process at the right time. It's something we work on very hard, and you will see in our annual reports over the last few years where we've been reporting on the kind of stakeholder outreach that we've had, that the amount of that has increased significantly. But it's getting to the right people, the actual people that are preparing the financial statements across the whole country, and not just at the moment a lot of municipalities are participating in that process. We find that people only really pay attention to standards that we develop once they have to implement them. So at the moment, the national and provincial departments aren't really taking any interest in it, other than through the Department of Cooperative Governance or Treasury, depending on who the driver in the province are for oversight over the municipalities. But the preparers in the departments themselves are not really involved in that process. I've talked about staff and trying to find the right staff. We really are struggling with that. We think that we could recruit any chartered accountant, but chartered accountants have to, the ones we're looking for has to have an academic interest. It's people who can sit in their own office and study technical documents and come up with proposals on how to improve accounting in South Africa. And they're not that many of them. They are all mostly employed by the large accounting firms in their technical departments already. And we cannot compete on a salary basis. The other challenge we have is the capacity to implement, and that's why the specific thing we did this last year was say, do an outreach to all the municipalities that have to implement those six new standards to make sure they know what they have to do before the financial year starts. And really, if you look back at one of the slides that I presented this morning, implementation is not the Accounting Standards Board's responsibility. It's the responsibility of the Accountant General. And so by doing those works, those workshops, we were really outside our mandate. But we believe it's important that we do that to create awareness of what's coming down the line. One of the questions you asked is interaction with National Treasury. Obviously, it's twofold. On the one hand, we have to report to the National Treasury because we're a public entity under the auspices of the Minister of Finance. And secondly, it's with regards to standard setting, and we have a really good working relationship with the Office of the Accountant General. They participate in all our project groups. They comment on all our documents. Freeman Nombolo is one of the board members, but because of his diary and responsibilities, that he has an alternate, Lindy Bodewijk, and she attends all our board meetings whenever possible. Once we've developed the standard, we rely heavily on both the Auditor General and the Accountant General to advise us on the capacity to implement those standards by the various entities. And so during that process of assessing the capacity, they develop accounting guides, and we are involved with them in making sure those guides are appropriate and practical and capable of implementation. Often when we do workshops that relate to implementation, we are accompanied by staff from the Office of the Accountant General so that they can deal with the implementation issues and we deal with theoretical issues, the standards. And that's similar to what we do with the Office of the Auditor General. Other than the trilateral meeting with the Auditor General, we also have Wednesday meetings, we call them, during the audit cycle, both the departmental audit cycle and the municipal audit cycle. We technical people from my office and from the Accountant General's office and from the Auditor General meet to resolve issues that are coming up that are identified during the audit cycle. I think that the question was regarding the quality of the financial statements submitted for audit and the use of consultants. And it's a huge problem because we've seen, particularly in the recent municipal audit cycle and the report by the Auditor General, that positions are being filled. But despite that, they also employ consultants. And the question we have is, well, are those people that are being appointed suitably skilled to perform their activity? Because it's their responsibility to prepare the financial statements, and they shouldn't be using consultants. Unfortunately, we have no mandate to regulate the consultants. What we have done is we arrange one workshop a year where we invite these consultants to come and meet with us, and then we deal with some of the audit issues, not audit issues, but the accounting issues that were identified during the audit cycle. And alert them to new standards that are coming in and give them the same implementation information that we've been given to the municipalities. Sorry, I'm talking too much.
Companies Act have been to make it easier for small businesses to do business in South Africa. And it's for that reason that if you fall under a certain threshold, you no longer need an audit, but something they call an independent review. And if you fall even under a lower threshold, then you don't even have to have an independent review. You can just compile financial statements. And that is what impacted on the RBA, where audits were required in the past. It's only required now for really public interest entities. And I think that is how government tried to make it a bit easier for a small business. The issue on the table at the moment is those independent reviewers. They are still providing assurance to the public, and at the moment they're not subject to any regulation, and government has to decide whether they want them to be regulated. And if they are regulated, obviously it will have to be at a lower level than auditors. Auditors are regulated at the highest level. Independent reviewers will have to be regulated at a much lower level to comply with government's objectives to save costs for the companies. From our side also, our inspections in the past, we performed inspections on auditors of all clients. We've changed that now to, and I'm talking now from the small practitioner, not from the small business. Small practitioners in auditing, we used to perform inspections on all of them. We've changed that now to focus on the inspections of auditors of high-risk entities, and which includes things like listed companies, medical aids, etc. And I'll come back to the listed companies when I talk about the funding model. On the black economic empowerment side, we have the DTI's legislation is in the process of being finalized to appoint the RBA as the regulator of the verification industry. At the moment, what has been approved last year was for auditors to provide these services, and they're already registered with the RBA. However, if the other 80 verification agents out there want to register with us, they're not allowed to do that because we've got no mandate to regulate them. But when our act is amended, it will allow us to do that. But until our legislation is changed, and it's with National Treasury at the moment, until our legislation is changed, we cannot really do anything for any verification agents that are not registered auditors. What we have done in the meantime was to develop a standard for regulating this industry, and we've developed that together with the DTI and current verification professionals who are not auditors, because they have done this work since the BEE legislation came into place, and they have the expertise. So if we do start to regulate that verification profession, we will have to do it at a very different level than we regulate auditors. But in the meantime, we have worked on issuing a guide to them. We haven't been able to publicize much around our role, our future role as a regulator. The DTI specifically requested us, because they're handing over this role from the DTI, they've requested us not to say anything much at this stage until our legislation and their legislation has been amended. But as soon as the amendments have been passed, I think we'll be ready to regulate the industry. We have started to develop a competency framework for BEE verification professionals. I think the member mentioned that as a regulator, we also have to ensure that people are appropriately qualified to issue those certificates. And the reason that the Minister of the DTI requested the RBA to take over this role is because there might be people out there at the moment that are issuing certificates, but the verification agents aren't properly qualified and nobody's controlling what certificates they issue. And I think the Minister wants that industry, of course, to be more tightly regulated, because issuing a certificate must be reliable, because business and transformation depends on the reliability of that certificate. So when it comes to the disciplinary action against false certificates, the RBA will certainly be a lot stricter than they are with auditors, even though they will regulate them differently. I think any false certificates will be strictly responded to by the RBA. But we can only start doing that once our legislation has been changed, and we're hoping it will be soon. On the international, the fact that we have to issue international comparable standards, that has been a specific requirement from the then Minister of Finance, because of the fact that no matter how we look at it, we are operating in a global environment. There's no more South Africa, America, Europe. There is now just the world, and business takes place across borders. If you want to deal with other countries, you have to be able to understand what standards they use. And so if we want to operate at an international level and do business internationally, those other countries need to understand what are the standards that we are using, and that is why the international standards are being adopted by most countries around the world. Even on the auditing side, it's also developing countries, because without that, there can be no confidence in the standards. And the adoption has not been a process that required a lot of investment for South Africa. We've been working on the adoption that happened in 2005, say from 1994. We've been harmonizing our standards over the years to try and come in line with what's happening. But what we mustn't forget is that international standards are just a part of our standards that we issue. And those we just adopt. We go through a process. If we're not happy with them, we won't adopt them. But generally, we adopt international standards. But the biggest part of our work program consists of developing local guidance, because the international standards, there's not much more to do there. Bearing in mind that we influence those standards, we serve on those committees, we influence them, so we will not adopt the standard where we didn't have a lot of inputs. But locally, we have to respond to the needs of regulators. We work closely with the JSE, the FSB, the National Clearance Regulator, for example. And if they need any guidance issues to auditors, we spend our investment is mostly in issuing local guidance. We also have a standing committee that deals with the Auditor General's office to help the Auditor General issue guidance for auditors in the public sector. So I think we will ensure that we don't focus on international only, but that we make sure that we respond to the needs of the local environment as well. If I can then go, I think that was all the members' questions. Can go on to the second set of questions on the annual report. What we've included in our report are to comply with the minimum requirements for corporate governance, and I believe that we've tried our best to only include what was necessary in terms of good governance. And all the information that we disclose, and I'll give you an example, the information on the generally recognized accounting practice, for example, it takes up a lot of pages, but we have no choice but to disclose it, otherwise the Auditor General will qualify our financial statements. We actually reduced our costs from the previous year. I think when I look back at our previous year, the cost for our report was 300,000, and we've worked hard to reduce that to 181,000 in the current year. We also don't print our reports unless it's for, we have to print the minimum amount that comes to Parliament, and then we just keep a few copies on hand so that this report isn't distributed widely or printed. We don't have a huge bulk of printing involved. So it's really just to satisfy Parliament's requirements. And I didn't know whether the 5 or 6 odd pictures were that many, but we can try and reduce that going forward as well. Sorry, Dean? So that was really the annual report, but trying to reduce from 300 to 181, we'll continue to keep those costs low as well. I wasn't sure what the member meant by the CEO salary, so I won't respond to that. The 10 million rand for the building, when we became the independent regulatory board for auditors, our legislation changed, and it necessitated the PAAB to increase its staff from 30 members to 70 members, because the new requirements on the regulator had become a lot stronger. The old building, which could only accommodate 30 members, became too small, and we had to move to a building to accommodate a staff of 70 and to provide for any growth in the organization, which has now materialized with the Black Economic Empowerment, and it might realize further with the independent review if we take that over as well. So At the time, the board also decided that the RBA is a standard-setting regulator. We're not in property, in owning buildings and property, so they didn't want to own a building, and they then decided to rather lease a building. And I can give the members the assurance that that lease is above board. On the trade receivables, the inspections that were high, the last period of the last month of the period had 5 weeks. So because we were busy for the full 5 weeks, it appears that the outstanding amounts at the end of the year were a lot higher. It was a 5-week period. Of that, about 3.2 million was in the 30-day, less than 90-day period. So it pushed, a lot of those were current, and then a lot of those were collected after the year end. On the bad debts that we wrote off, it really relates mostly to disciplinary fines. When we fine an auditor, the auditor might resign, the auditor might have, they're not auditing anymore, and we simply cannot trace them, or we simply cannot recover the money. But we have a policy and a formal process before we can write off any bad debts. And those amounts then are really when we know there's no, we go through a process first, and when we get to a point where it's costing us more to recover the debt, we have to take a decision to write it off. And that's how those amounts came about. The loans are study loans only. The license fees are, the terminology is license fees, but it is registration fees. The board members' meeting attendance are on page 46 of our report. And you'll note that from the board members' attendance at board meetings, five attended all the meetings, four missed one meeting, and one missed three meetings. But our committee expenses are quite high because the board consists of 70 people and we operate on statutory committees. Our Act requires us to establish statutory committees, and therefore a lot of our expenses go to the payment of those committees. In the past, we didn't pay committee members, but when our new legislation came about, we started to pay them in terms of recommendations from government. And so there's a huge cost in meeting attendance. You also find that in the rest of our annual report, you've got the statutory committees attendance at the meetings. And to relate the board members' fees to their meeting attendance, one should not only look at the board attendance, but also their membership of other board committees like the audit committee or the disciplinary committee or the disciplinary advisory committee. A lot of the board members also serve in those committees. So in order to tally the income that they get, it's not only the board attendance, it's those as well. The other expenses consist of, we've just lumped telephone, things like cleaning, security, and entertainment together in the 1.6 million. So that wasn't further described, but that is the what it's made up of. The decrease of the committee expenses of 900,000 resulted mainly from, there was one disciplinary case that we set down and budgeted for the period under review, and the case didn't materialize. Now, one of those cases to hear a disciplinary case could cost up to R1 million, and this particular case wasn't heard in that year. The reason the disciplinary committee expenses are so high is because we've got advocates and judges sitting in those committees, and therefore they charge a lot more. And if they do sit, it's not a three-hour meeting, it's sometimes a five-day meeting. So the budget, we budgeted for one particular case which didn't materialize, and therefore that was almost R1 million that we saved on the committee costs. I agree that the audit fees are high. To note that the audit fees consist of the internal audit fees and the external audit fees, but I do agree that our external audit fees are too high, but unfortunately we are, I don't want to say held ransom by the Auditor General. There's nobody else to audit us. So we have to be audited by the Auditor General, and we're subject to what they tell us the fees are going to be. Our new model for funding, what we've tried to move from for now, and we're only implementing this new model this year, is to not base the inspection on the number of hours that are spent at an audit firm on inspections anymore. It's too direct. So what we've done is we've asked auditors to submit to us the fees that they collect from different levels of clients. We've categorized them in A, B, and C. A being high-risk clients, B being special clients like Black Economic Empowerment, and then C being low-risk clients. Now, we believe that we should be focusing on the high-risk clients, and therefore, when they submit their fee base to us, we will then calculate the percentage of the high-risk clients and charge the auditors for those clients. What it means is that it's not a direct charge anymore, and we're actually saying that the auditors are getting huge fees from those big audits, and therefore they should pay a fee for that. It's like a levy. Our first choice, of course, because our high-risk clients are mostly listed entities, first choice is to get the JSE to recover that through a levy like every other country. But the JSE is not very keen to do that, and therefore we had to move to a different model to recover the monies ourselves, but on a different basis, on the assurance base of the auditor. Yes, the Companies Act has had some impact on the small practitioners in the smaller areas, but we believe that the environment and the market will adjust itself. What we've seen happening, when we did our roadshows last year, a concern was expressed to us, and because we can't run their business for them, we just said to them, the market will adjust. Those small business will probably move to independent reviews, and because there's a lot of independence requirements, you can't do both anymore. So I think what is happening in the market is the auditors and the independent reviewers are swapping accounting and auditing work, and that's what we suspected would happen, and I think that is what's happening. So I think the market is just adjusting itself to this new regime, which we had no control over, unfortunately. It was the Companies Act, and I think the Companies Act moved in the right direction. People always complain when something happens and change comes about, but they adapt to it because they have to adapt to it, and I think that is what's happening at the moment. And then finally, I think the chairman's questions, first the registered versus unregistered. The RBA, when I refer to a registered auditor, let me take one step back. If you're a chartered accountant, you are a member of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. There's about 35,000 chartered accountants in South Africa, of which 5,000 are abroad. Of those 35,000 chartered accountants, if you want to be an auditor, you have to register with the RBA because you are performing a public function and you need to be regulated. Chartered accountants are not regulated. They are the ones providing tax services together with other accounting bodies, but they're not subject to any regulation. But if you do an audit and you give assurance on financial statements on which the public relies and make investing decisions, then you have to be regulated and they have to register with the RBA. Now, we are aware that there are people that hold themselves out to be auditors. I'm not talking about accountants giving tax advice. I'll come to that now. There are people that sign off financial statements as auditors. Now, our Act provides that if we become aware of that, anybody can report such a person to us. It's called a holding out. Then we can take legal action against them. At least the RBA doesn't have jurisdiction over them, but we refer them to the police because it is fraud. So we get quite a few holding outs reported to us every year. And there's really quite a few people that are doing this. So our legal department actually reports those to the police. And that's all we can do because we've got no jurisdiction over those people. We've only got jurisdiction over the 4,500 registered auditors. Over the tax practitioners and accountants, we've got no jurisdiction either. But what I think is going to happen, and I don't want to look too far into the future, the World Bank has just paid us a visit and they performed a review of our standards and codes. They do that every 10 years and they've just completed one. We'll get the report in December, so maybe the members can look out for that. But I know one of their concerns is that there should be more regulation of those other services as well. At the moment, the RBA can only regulate audits. We'll get in the BE, and if we can regulate the independent review, we'll do that. But accountants in general are not subject to any regulation. I think there might be a move to get them to become regulated because they are providing a lot of services on which the public rely, but unfortunately the RBA has no jurisdiction over them. The only ones that we can take action against are those that are reported to us as signing off as auditors when in fact they are not auditors. Any big firms disappoint us? We don't believe that any firm is not capable of making mistakes and not producing a good audit. And I wouldn't say a reputable firm. I'd refer to them as the Big Four. Those are the international firms, the global networks. There is no difference between them and any other firm. They could just as easily be subject to mistakes, and we do have findings. We produce an annual report to say what the findings were in general over the last year, and that includes big firms, so we don't treat them any differently. We don't expect anything different from them. And then the question on do we approve other regulators in other countries? don't have any such mutual agreement with any other country. We do not believe at this stage, unless we go through a process, that any other accountancy profession anywhere in the world are qualified at the level that our auditors are, and therefore unless they can write our examinations, they are not, we can't approve them. We don't have any such arrangement. There's a lot of push from other countries. America has approached us. They want their auditors to audit here. We cannot accept that unless we've gone through testing the competencies, etc. The Institute has such arrangements to say, if you're a CA in South Africa, you can work as a CA in America, an American CA can work in South Africa. We don't have that for auditors. It's a public function. If they write our exam and they pass our competencies, we can allow them to audit here. Unfortunately, our Act also says that you have to be a resident of South Africa. So even if they are Americans, they have to actually become residents in South Africa, write our examination, and then we'll allow them to audit here. And again, it's only because it's a public function. They have to go through the same process as our auditors. But there's a lot of push from other countries for us to recognize their auditing qualification. And I think the chairman's question was just on the on Africa. What we have done is we appreciate the fact that we've achieved a lot in terms of our ranking in the world, and we need to support the rest of Africa. The World Bank has also recognized that. They have now, we've just completed a contract with the World Bank where they gave us funds to set up an inspections department in Zimbabwe. And I think we're halfway through that project. We've established now, we will help with auditing standards and with independent regulation. Good governance in any country means that the audit regulator must be independent of the profession. And I think in South Africa we've achieved that with our new legislation. And therefore the World Bank recognizes that, and they've asked us to assist other countries to also set up independent regulation. In Zimbabwe, for example, the inspections are done by the profession themselves. Now, the world has moved away from self-regulation. It must be independent regulation. So in terms of the contract with the World Bank, they gave us some money, and we've sent staff there to train people, but it's not just training and leaving, it's building up the capacity. There was a full program that the World Bank had to approve, and we'll be completing that project at the end of September. If the World Bank is satisfied that this pilot project was a success, it will become a much bigger project for Africa, and we'll move on to the other countries to assist them as well. And I believe that it's successful so far. And so we'll probably move into some of the other African countries, neighboring countries, and then further in Africa. The idea really is to start to establish a forum in Africa. For the accountancy profession, there are forums that look after accountancy. We want to do the same for audit regulation, and that is what the World Bank wants to achieve. But they view South Africa as the RBA as a basis to start rolling that out in Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gallas. Thank you to the ASB and IRBA for your presentations. The overall objective, Honourable Members, is good governance and sound financial management. The Honourable Ministers were invited here, but as you know, the G20 summit was in Mexico, and they are not back yet, so we wish them well there, and the role they play to put our case forward for South Africa and Africa. Honourable Members, we've listened to the presentations and you asked your questions in terms of deliberations. I want to put the report now before the comment. Yes, Honourable Mashile.
I think you raised one point which, you know, I'll really be sick if I go home without just elevating it. He's talking to markets to respond on their own. You are responding to one particular question. I just wanted to raise this matter, Chair, that we also advocate ourselves in South Africa as an interventionist state, where we intervene deliberately on a matter that we need to give direction. And so I'm just talking to that view that you are taking, that you just completely leave a thing and say, let the market deal with it. But we are an interventionist state as well. While we are developmental, we can only be developmental by
Chancellor, Dr. Merkel, in terms of the market issue in Europe, but specific in Germany. And it was captured in Business Day on the front page. You can't leave everything to the markets. That was the headlines of Business Day, that specific Thursday morning. We got a lecture from Professor Tarak on that. Honourable members, thank you. We are engaged now with the two entities. I request your permission that we then put the report to the committee that will have to be 80 seats. I'm going to read to you. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the report and financial statements of the Accounting Standards Board for 2010-2011 financial year, including the report of the independent auditors on the financial statements and performance information for 2010-2011, referred to it, reports that it has concluded its deliberations thereon. I put this report to the committee. Can we get a mover and a seconder? Honourable Mashile proposed and Honourable Chani seconds. Thank you. Honourable members. The second one, the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the report and financial statements of the Independent Regulatory Board for auditors for 2010-2011, including the report of the Auditor General on the financial statements and performance information for 2010-2011, referred to it, reports that it has concluded its deliberations thereon. Can I get a mover and a seconder? Honourable Chani proposes, and Honourable Mashile seconds. Thank you, Honourable Members. That concludes this part of the meeting. We are all human beings. We're going to break for about 10 minutes, just a comfort break, while our delegations from National Treasury will put up their presentations. And it's now 10 minutes to 12. Let's try to be back at 12 o'clock. Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Gallas, you are welcome to stay, but have a cup of tea and you are released. No, sorry, I forgot. But you're welcome to stay if you want to stay. Members, thank you for your cooperation. The team in front of us are very familiar with this committee from Treasury, dealing with the international agreements, also relating to the tax matters. We've got three agreements to deal with the government of Gibraltar, the Commonwealth of Dominica, and the government of the Republic of Liberia. The tax issues, and that Mr. Van der Merwe, right? Yeah. Well, I will also explain it to us. It's the same for all three countries, including then with South Africa. So, sir, over to you. You can zoom into it and take us through that. Have you got the documentation, honorable members? I do.
Similar to
the multilateral convention which South Africa signed in November last year. So there's been a complete campaign for exchange of information and transparency to combat tax evasion ever since the economic collapse, I think you could call it that, in about 2008. So with that introduction, Chair, the differences are simply this. The tax information exchange agreements, which I'll deal with first, with Dominica, with Gibraltar and with Liberia, are the same. They are with offshore financial centres. They are also aimed at exchange of information, but only on request, because that is the maximum standard that we've been able, the international community has been able to achieve with these offshore financial centres. So they're all much of a muchness. So if I could turn then, first of all, to Dominica. As we've said, the purpose of the agreement is to allow effective exchange of information. These agreements closely follow the OECD Model Tax Information Exchange Agreement, TIA, which forms the foundation for the vast majority of these TIAs. I'll just use that phrase worldwide. The TIA ensures that bank secrecy or the absence of a domestic tax interest can no longer be used to deny a request for exchange of information. And the articles in these three agreements are as follows. Article 1 deals with the scope of the agreement. It says that exchange of information that is foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of the domestic laws of the parties concerning taxes and tax matters is covered by the agreement, including information that's foreseeably relevant to determination, assessment, enforcement, or collection of tax with respect to persons who are subject to such taxes, or to investigation and prosecution of criminal tax matters in relation to those persons. The requested party shall ensure that effective exchange of information is not unduly prevented or delayed. What we've said there, Chair, is simply that if you unduly delay a request, it's the same as not giving us the information, because eventually you can't do anything with it. Taxes covered. In all the agreement shall apply to any identical taxes imposed after the date of signature of the agreement, in addition to or in place of the existing taxes, or any substantially similar taxes if the parties so agree. So we look to the future to say that when we introduce new taxes, like for argument's sake, South Africa next year will have the withholding tax on interest, that we would then merely have to we'd have to inform our treaty partners of the new tax. It's substantially similar to the other taxes already covered, and therefore would be covered without further negotiation or protocols or whatever. Article 5. And now we start looking at how we can exchange information. Information shall be exchanged without regard to whether the requested party needs that information for its own tax purposes. In other words, there doesn't have to be a domestic tax interest in the requested party for that party to give you the information. And also whether conduct being investigated would constitute a crime under the laws of the requested party. Concept of dual criminality, but that's only on request. Domestic law in both states should allow for exchange of information held by banks, other financial institutions, and any person, including nominees and trustees, acting in an agency or fiduciary capacity. Also, information regarding the legal and beneficial ownership of companies, partnerships, foundations, and other persons, including in the case of collective investment schemes, information on shares, units, and other interests, and then in the case of trusts, information on settlers, trustees, protectors, which is not something we have in South Africa, but the other jurisdictions do, and beneficiaries. So what we're saying is that the countries, and this is what they've signed up to, need to have full
ownership information of all these entities. It does not create an obligation for a party to obtain or provide ownership information with respect to publicly traded companies or public collective investment schemes unless that information can be obtained without giving rise to disproportionate difficulties. It also allows for tax examinations abroad. It allows for representatives of the competent authority of the requesting party to enter the territory of the requested party to the extent permitted under its domestic law. So you always have to say, well, what does my domestic law allow? It allows for presence at interviews conducted by the requested party. And there I just want to highlight, if we, for argument's sake, send our investigators to the other country, they can be present at the interview, but it has to be led by the officials of the party we are visiting. And all of it is subject to approval of the requested party in line with domestic law. Excuse me. Article 7 deals with possibilities of declining a request. Competent authority may decline to assist where the disclosure of the information requested would be contrary to public policy. It does not impose any obligation to provide items which are subject to legal privilege or any trade, business, industrial, commercial, or professional secret or trade process. And it can be refused on the ground that the tax claim giving rise to the request is disputed by the taxpayer under examination or investigation. These are the same kind of exclusions which we find also in our double taxation agreements dealing with this particular area. Confidentiality, once again, all information provided and received by competent authorities of the parties is subject to confidentiality. It shall be disclosed only to persons or authorities, including courts and administrative bodies concerned with the purposes specified in Article 1, and that is the assessment, collection, etc. of taxes. Information received may not be used for any purpose other than those purposes in Article 1 without express written consent of the competent authority of the requested party. So that allows you, in cases where perhaps you have a money laundering case or whatever, you can go to that party that gave you that information and say, please, may we use this in this case? We need your written consent under this particular article. Costs is Article 9. Unless the competent authorities of the parties otherwise agree, indirect costs incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the requested party, and direct costs incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the requesting party. What we do in these cases is normally once we've ratified an agreement, Chair, we do a memorandum of understanding with our treaty partner which sets out what is direct costs, what are indirect costs. And the indirect costs would be, for argument's sake, where they had to get a translator to translate a whole pile of documents into the English language so we could understand that. That's a considerable cost. And they would tell us, look, we're going to have to do this. It's going to cost that much. Do you want to carry on? And then you've got to see whether the information is going to bring you enough to make it worthwhile. Article 10, mutual agreement procedure that deals with the implementation or interpretation of this agreement and simply says that where there are any difficulties or doubts, the competent authorities shall use their best efforts to resolve the matter by mutual agreement. Now, Chair, the agreements with Gibraltar and with Liberia follow that exact pattern. So I can go through them. I've got slides here, but it would be repetition. I can do it with pleasure if you want.
Machine. Pardon? It doesn't look like
that. Yeah, it doesn't look like, Chair, because that's what I just wanted to raise. You know, it's, I looked on the articles, they are different, which means certain articles I think have been removed or altered or shifted to certain article numbers. Because when I looked, this specific one that we are speaking to, South Africa, Dominica. That's the one that we have been dealing with. And then these issues which are on article, what was that? The article numbers are not corresponding directly with the next one of Gibraltar. If we can just check on that and just indicate to us what is there that has been removed.
And you,
if ever there is anything that has been removed.
Could you just quickly reassure that and just explain to us?
My colleague says it's probably a problem with the slide because Dominica goes from 1 to 3. Articles 1 to 3. Yes. It's a problem with the numbering of the slides.
There's a problem with the numbering. What about these?
Mr. Chairman, I just put aside the slides and I've just quickly pulled out the actual agreements, which we've also got. And Honourable Moshida, I think, is correct. If you look at the actual agreements, Article 1 and 2, I'm just comparing Gibraltar with Dominica. Article 1 is scope of agreement on both, but Article 2 on the one is jurisdiction, the other one is taxes covered. Whether that's a material or it's simply a change in layout, and then Article 3 on Dominica is taxes covered, whereas Article 3 on Gibraltar is general definition. So there's a numbering. There's an inclusion in Dominica of jurisdiction which doesn't exist in the Gibraltar one.
Yeah, you see, before we pass this or approve this, we must approve the correct agreements in terms of the...
And sorry, Mr. Chairman, just to finish off, I haven't been right through if you see any other differences, but just picked up on that.
Yeah.
Chair, if it helps, I can do them one by one. It's not an issue.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't think it's necessary to do one by one as long as there's some explanation as to why the one has a jurisdiction article and the other one doesn't, for instance. Or is it the explanation that jurisdiction I'll find later in the agreement, perhaps?
You just give clarity on the technical stuff.
If there is any section chair where there is a change, just highlight. Leave it only that change.
Yes. Just lift it up.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry. Yes. I'll just work through going through the agreement as it is, and point out where there are any differences. And I do apologise. The slides are actually done on the basis of what is of interest in the agreement, as opposed to every single article. So.
You want?
Yes. I can carry on. If I could move to the Republic of Liberia. First of all, Article 1 has the same scope of the agreement as pointed out in Dominica. It includes all information foreseeably relevant. All those things remain the same. Taxes covered, taxes of every kind and description. It also has the paragraph which says that identical taxes imposed after the date or similar taxes will also be covered. Article 3 in all of them is general definitions. Article 4 in, what am I doing, Liberia, is exchange of information on request, and that merely sets out the full parameters of the kind of information which shall be held, the ownership information, no obligation in respect of public collective investment schemes or publicly traded companies. It also sets out the information that you have to give when you're asking, when you're making this request. So there's no difference there. Tax examinations abroad under Article 5 has the same restrictions in that you can declining a request, and we've had a look at that. Also, and confidentiality under Article 7, the same standards of confidentiality. Also, it may not be used for any other purpose without the express written consent. Article 8 deals with costs and once again splits it into indirect costs and direct costs. Article 9 has the mutual agreement procedure, and Article 10 has implementation legislation, which just says that the parties shall enact any legislation necessary to comply with and give effect to the terms of this agreement. So immediately the other country agrees to this, they can't come back to you and say, but the law in our country doesn't allow it. There's an undertaking that they will implement legislation to enable this exchange of information. That's Liberia. I could move then. Excuse me. Sorry, that was Gibraltar. What am I talking about? Have I got Gibraltar here? You've got Liberia. Just find it. Sorry, Chair, 1 minute. Gibraltar, Chair. Scope of the agreement is the standard paragraph. Taxes covered. Once again, every kind. Also, the paragraph talking about future taxes. It's all there. Article 3, the normal general definitions. Article 4 deals with exchange of information upon request, giving all the ownership details that have to be kept. Also, the particulars that you have to give when you asking for information. Article 5 deals with tax examinations abroad. Article 6, possibility of declining a request. The same exemptions from providing information. Article 7, confidentiality. Again, the same kind of standards for confidentiality. And then also express written consent if you want to use it for other purposes. Article 8 on costs is the same. Article 9 has the mutual agreement procedure, and that's the whole of Gibraltar there. There's no differences there. Chair, I just want to say that most of these agreements, we send our model. So 9 times out of 10, the partner country has accepted what we're proposing, and that is the case in these three. So those are the three, with Dominica, Liberia, and Gibraltar, Chair.
Does that conclude your whole presentation? No, I think are there any questions on this? Honourable members, yes, Honourable Mashili.
Well, Chair, I think it's just simply for clarity. Is that in some of the articles we are saying the requested parties will assist as far as their laws permit. And then come this last article that expects them for the implementation then to promulgate laws so that then they should comply. I'm just raising that when it goes back and then you must just simply try and look at it, what is its effect? Because it just simply says that I think it's article number 9 shall use their best efforts to I think I'm just mixing it, but where he's actually talking that they would do something for the implementation of this particular agreement. But whereas on one side you protect these particular requested parties to say they can only perform as far as their policies permit. So I'm just looking at it, just there is some level of contradiction which people may hold on not to promulgate a particular legislation to implement or to delay whatever. So
just answer to that question. It's true that in, I think it's the Gibraltar Agreement, there's an article which says that they will implement this legislation, which is not there in the other two. That is a difference, and that's why I dealt with that article. I think what we need to focus on is that Article 4, dealing with exchange of information upon request, doesn't make it whether you feel like doing it or not. It says you shall, and shall is an obligation. Where you do have some kind of discretion is in regard to a tax examination abroad. There I agree with the Honourable Member. It's up to the other state to say, if you want to go and do a tax examination abroad, what does my domestic law allow? But that is not the case with the exchange of information, Chair. That's an absolute obligation, and you know, these countries are all members of the Global Forum on transparency and exchange of information. And if they don't perform, they will be in somewhat trouble as members of that Global Forum. So I think we just need to make it clear that the exchange of information shall be done. There's no question of not doing it. With a tax examination abroad, yes, you have the opportunity, if your domestic law would not allow it, to say, I can't do that.
Any other questions? None. Mr. Fnaro, you can then proceed with the rest of your presentation.
Thank you, Chair. The next one I want to do is the Multilateral Convention. This convention has now been signed by 35 countries, one of whom was South Africa, who signed in November of 2011. Those 35 member countries are increasing as we speak, just from Africa. Ghana, Kenya, and Tunisia have applied to become signatories to this convention. The difference between this particular convention and those three tiers is that all dealt with information on request. If you sign up to the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, it takes you to the same standard of exchange of information as South Africa has in 70 double taxation agreements which are currently operational and ratified by both this House and the National Assembly. So it takes it another level. And if I go through the slides, I will mention those areas where this in fact goes further than the tier and gives you greater powers than under a tax information exchange agreement. So if I go to the first slide here, the purpose of the convention is to allow for effective exchange of information and administrative assistance, to increase cooperation among tax authorities to combat tax avoidance and evasion. It closely follows the articles on exchange of information and assistance collection in both the OECD and the United Nations Model Tax Convention. The articles of interest in this particular multilateral are as follows. Article 1 sets out the object, and it allows for administrative assistance which comprises of exchange of information, including simultaneous tax examinations and participation in tax examinations abroad, assistance in the recovery of taxes, that's in addition, and also the service of documents. Article 2, dealing with taxes covered, the convention applies to the widest possible range of taxes imposed by the parties. However, you are free as a signatory to this convention to enter a reservation as to which taxes you want to cover. And that I'll deal with later in the presentation. Turning to Section 1, Article 4, the exchange of information. It's a general provision again which says that there will be a full exchange of information irrespective of the domestic laws of the parties concerned, in enforcing the domestic laws of the parties concerned relating to taxes covered by the Convention. Article 5, exchange of information on request. This area is similar to what you find in a TIA, exchange on request. If we look to the next slide, though, it says, with respect to categories of cases and in accordance with procedures which they shall determine by mutual agreement, two or more parties shall automatically exchange the information referred to in Article 4. Chair, I think it's true to say that this is the ultimate goal for most tax authorities, to have an automatic exchange of information, because that is the fullest possible exchange, and it's something that most of us are working on to ensure that we are in fact able to do so. The next slide says a party shall, without prior request, forward to another party information of which it has knowledge. We call that a spontaneous exchange of information. So if I was auditing a case and I saw something which would be of interest to, say, the tax authority in, well, Botswana is not a signatory, but let's say Botswana, I would spontaneously send that information to Botswana even though they had not requested it. So these are the same standards which are set in all of our double taxation agreements. Article 8 deals with simultaneous tax examination. The idea of a simultaneous tax examination is that two or more parties in their own territories may investigate a case and exchange information with each other to ensure that you do a full and comprehensive tax examination, although you're doing it in your own state. But there is an exchange of information to enable you to do it properly. And this in itself, Chair, has been one of the issues where South Africa has been trying to set up multilaterals within Africa to be able to do simultaneous tax examinations of certain multinationals which operate in more than one African country. Article 9, tax examinations abroad. Well, once again, that's similar to the kind of powers which are there under the Tax Information Exchange Agreement, the TIA. But here, countries are allowed to reserve their position. If their domestic law is such that they are not allowed to allow officials from another jurisdiction onto their territory, then they can enter a reservation on this article. South Africa will not do that. We are not entering a reservation on that. Article 11 deals with the recovery of tax claims. This is similar to the assistance in collection article, which is now a feature of our more modern double taxation agreements. It allows us, on the basis of reciprocity, to approach a treaty partner and say, we have a tax debt. The person is in your country. We are unable to collect in our country. We've tried everything. Importantly, the tax claim is final. It's gone through all the court procedures that it could have gone in your country. In other words, it's finally collectible. But let's say the assets are in the other country. We can approach that treaty partner and say, please, will you collect this debt for us? And the agreement says that you use the full powers of your domestic law to collect that debt in the other state. When I say your domestic law, the party we're requesting to collect this for us. Article 12 also says that we can do measures of conservancy. If we think that the taxpayer is suddenly going to liquidate assets or disappear with the money, we can ask our treaty partner to take measures of conservancy to ensure that that does not happen. Article 17 deals with the service of documents. I'll come back to this because South Africa has entered a reservation here. We are saying that we do not do service of documents. Sure, you can send your documents by post. That's not an issue. But we consider that the MLAT, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, which goes through the Department of Justice and DIRCO, is sufficient for for service of documents, and therefore we don't want to include that in this particular multilateral. And many of the signatories have also entered similar reservations. Article 21 has, once again, exclusions. The convention does not impose an obligation on the requested state to provide assistance in the following circumstances. Now, the first three are virtually identical, first four are virtually identical with what we have as exclusions in double taxation agreements. Carry out measures at variance with law and administrative practices, to carry out measures which would be contrary to public policy, to supply information which is not obtainable under its own law or administrative practice, or under the laws of the applicant state or its administrative practice. And finally, to supply information which would disclose any trade, business, industrial, commercial, or professional secret or trade process or information, the disclosure of which would be contrary to public policy. We do not have to provide administrative assistance if we consider that the taxation in the applicant state is contrary to generally accepted taxation principles or to the provisions of a convention. Now, one of the things that is looked at before you even become a signatory to this convention is, what is your tax system? And provided your tax system is more or less in line with generally accepted taxation principles, nobody has a problem with it. And finally, under F, we would not provide administrative assistance if the state requesting it is going to use that to discriminate against the national of your own country. And I think that's also fair. And then G, to provide administrative assistance if you yourself have not pursued all reasonable measures. In other words, you can't just sit back and say to the other country, I'm a bit lazy today, you do the work for me. You have to show that you've done all reasonable measures in your country before you can ask. And then finally, to provide assistance in recovery where the administrative burden for the state asked to collect is disproportionate to the benefit to be derived by the applicant state. If it's going to cost them $100,000 to collect $20,000 for you, clearly that should not be continued. Sorry, Chair, I need some water. Article 22 is secrecy or confidentiality. It has the same kind of protection for secrecy and confidentiality as you would find under TIA. It's protected in the same manner as information obtained under the domestic law of that party, disclosed only to persons or authorities, including courts and administrative bodies or supervisory bodies. The information can be disclosed in a public court proceeding or in judicial decisions relating to such taxes. Costs here, instead of indirect and direct, we talk about ordinary costs and extraordinary costs. And the principle is the same. If it's ordinary costs, if you're simply looking at the time one of your colleagues or one of your officials would spend in getting this information, that's an ordinary cost. If you have to go out and hire an advocate or do translation, whatever, then that would fall under the definition, I think, of extraordinary costs. And then Article 27 says the assistance provided by this convention does not limit, nor is it limited by assistance contained in existing or future international agreements between the parties or other instruments which relate to cooperation in tax matters. And the result of that is simply that you would use the instrument that gives you the best result in obtaining this information. Reservations. Countries may enter reservations, but not in respect of the basic things like exchange of information or assistance in collection. If you're entering a reservation against that, well, you might as well not be a signatory. And in fact, they wouldn't ask you to become a signatory to the convention. And then also Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 requires that states must enter into declarations in terms of taxes which they will cover, the meaning of competent authority, and the meaning of the term national. So for that purpose, ratification, South Africa's formal ratification, which will include these reservations, declarations, and notifications as required, and will be sent to the depository, will advise, once it's been approved by both houses, that the following notifications will be made. Annex A, taxes to which the convention would apply: income tax, withholding tax on royalties, tax on foreign entertainers and sports persons, turnover tax on micro-businesses, secondary tax on companies, although it's now terminated as from 31 March 2012, the dividend tax, which effectively comes in from 1 April 2012, and the withholding tax on interest, where the effective date at this stage is 1 January 2013. Also, capital gains, estate duty, donations tax, transfer duty, value-added tax, excise tax, and securities transfer tax. Those are the taxes that we will cover in exchange of information. The notification competent authority is the Commissioner for the South African Revenue Service or an authorised representative of the Commissioner. Annex C, definition of the term national. We use the exact same definition that we have in all our double taxation agreements. Any individual possessing the nationality or citizenship of South Africa and any legal person, partnership, association, or other entity deriving its status as such from the laws in force in South Africa. The reservations we enter are as follows, Chair. And we will not provide any form of assistance in relation to taxes of the other parties as follows. Taxes on income, profits, capital gains, or net wealth, which are imposed on behalf of a political subdivision or local authority of a party. In other words, we do it for central government, but in South Africa, we don't impose those taxes at political subdivision or local authority level. So there's no reciprocity. Article 2, compulsory social security contributions payable to general government or to social security institutions established under public law, taxes on the use or ownership of motor vehicles, taxes on the use or ownership of movable property other than motor vehicles, and finally, taxes in those categories which are also imposed on behalf of political subdivisions or local authorities of a party, such as estate duty, consumption taxes like value-added tax, because they are not imposed at the level of political subdivisions or local authorities. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, Chair, Article 17, which dealt with the service of documents, we reserve not to do the service of documents because we consider that should be done under the mutual legal assistance treaties. But we do say that paragraph 3 of Article 17 is not an issue for us, and that's where it's served on people in our country by post. And that's the multilateral convention which we signed in November last year, Chair. And as I said, this gives you the same powers as you have under double taxation agreements, but it gives us a coverage at this stage already of 35 countries, many of whom we do not have double taxation agreements with, and some with whom we do have double taxation agreements are still operating under the old exchange of information article and no assistance in collection because those were not available when we negotiated them. So this gives us enormous coverage already. And as I said, Chair and members, more and more countries are signing up to this because of the value it has. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Van Merwe and your team. Honourable members, are there any questions? Honourable Lees, Honourable Mashile.
Just a quick one. Contents agreement aside, the 35 countries, have you got a list of those countries? I don't think we need to read them off necessarily, or I'd be... Yeah, thank you.
but why is this particular article kept in this agreement and continue to be kept in? What informs that? Did we try and understand why they wanted this extraordinary provision? Is there any knowledge of what informs the inclusion of this, while it is known that other countries have got other ways of saving the same? And are we putting a reservation because other countries are doing so, or are we completely satisfied that the provisions that we have in other legislations actually will serve that particular purpose to the extent of what the crafters of this would like to have? Thanks.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair, and as promised, I'll get my dear friend Cindy to make copies of this list as it was at the 29th of March of this year. Yes, there is a termination possibility. It's a general article. It's Article 31 in the agreement itself, which talks about denunciation. Any party may at any time denounce this convention by means of a notification addressed to one of the depositories. It shall become effective on the first day of the month following the expiration of a period of 3 months after the date of receipt of the notification by the depository. And any party which denounces the convention shall remain bound by the provisions of Article 22, and that's secrecy, for as long as it retains in its possession any documents or information which it obtained under the convention. And that's a normal provision. Just because you denounce something, it doesn't mean you can forego the secrecy on information which you agreed to at the start. Service of documents. We were not party to the actual drafting of this entire agreement. But our fear is this. We're a revenue authority, Chair. And when you're doing service of legal documents, I think there are certain legal formalities and approaches which need to be followed, in which we would certainly not be the experts. Justice certainly would be the experts, and that's why we, and I think other countries, would prefer to rely on that approach. However, some countries clearly have the resource to do it through the competent authority, which in most countries is the Revenue Service. I don't think that that's something that we would have sufficient expertise or capacity to start doing. So we prefer to join some other countries and say there are avenues to do this by the experts, and we would leave it at that.
Yeah, just a follow-up, Chair. Then on the declarations or reservations, have we created the link to justice when it comes to the servicing of documents? Because on one, you are saying the competent person is the commissioner of SARS. But then is there then a link that has been created that the commissioner then has got some reasonable authority then to actually link with justice, to actually perform, to actually facilitate the performance in terms of this particular convention? Thank you.
Are you relating just to the service of documents, or
yes.
Okay? No, there would not be a link. We would simply have reserved our position, and therefore, when this agreement is lodged at Durco, they would know that in terms of service of documents, they would use existing mutual legal assistance treaties. Sorry, I always get that thing wrong. The MLAT, that's as I understand it. So South Africa to follow existing channels. There is no new channel as such, and therefore there's no linkage to this to say to them, you must go to justice. That's the way it's been done for many years, and that's the way they would continue to do it. This particular agreement wouldn't give them any further, or give us any further powers.
Chair, I'm really not getting right. You see, the implementation of this particular protocol for them then need to be need performance. Now I'm saying, we say yes, our competent person is the SARS commissioner, but then in the process of actually implementing the content here, there is a point where the commissioner cannot do anything, waiting the Justice Department then to take its time and to do whatever, all sorts of things to do. Now, that's what I was just checking, is that is the commissioner going to be linked legally that he can actually facilitate that performance in the justice, whether to inquire as well? Because as you say, there's no link. That means he can only fold his arms and wait until justice has done what it has done, then so that the documents then are facilitated and reach the particular point. Then he starts now performing the duties that he's supposed to do. That's what I'm just trying to see, the operational. But I mean, it's, we're just talking, but it's not for the intention of changing this, because there's nothing to do that. But for us as well, also to look at the practical implications of actually complying with this. When you have got two authorities not linked, that one can check the other one whether it has performed or asked it to perform. And then when there is no link, and then but to comply with one convention, whether it is not practically going to give problems. Sometimes we may have been lucky for the past couple of years without that, but the practicality of what we are saying, it doesn't really say that we can't have that kind of a challenge. It doesn't say so. Thanks, Chair.
May I ask? I'd simply put it this way. Because we've entered a reservation in this particular agreement, in fact, the competent authority, being the commissioner, is saying it's not our responsibility to do this. You should follow the avenue of a mutual legal assistance treaty, and justice is responsible for that. And whether or not justice does what it's supposed to do under that treaty would then not be an issue for the competent authority under this agreement, because he's reserved his position and said, I will not be part of that that request as such. So the request cannot, for service, cannot be made to South Africa under this, to the commissioner under this particular convention at all. So I don't think there's a link in the responsibilities. We would simply be able to do everything else in the convention apart from the service of documents.
Honourable Lees?
Just to try and assist, Mr. Chairman, what this refers to is not our commissioner trying to get documents serviced in another country. It's with regard to another country getting documents serviced here. So that country would then go to the Justice Department to have their documents served, and it would happen. However, if we want documents served in another country and they haven't entered a reservation, our commissioner can then go directly to their relevant authority, as I understand it, if at the competent person. If they've entered a reservation, we would too have to then go to their justice or other department.
Honourable members, are you covered? Thank you. Having received these briefings on the three agreements with the three countries and South Africa, the content of the report to be tabled in the NCOP, the wording is precisely the same. The only difference is the Commissioner Dunkley's name. So I'm going to read the one on Gibraltar. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by the Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of Gibraltar for the exchange of information with respect to tax matters, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996, approve the said agreement. I put this agreement to the committee. Mover on Sheila and second by Honourable Lees. That goes for both for all three agreements. Then other members, what is also here, but it hasn't been officially referred to the Select Committee on Finance, is the formal ratification between South Africa and Oman, the tax treaty protocol. Pardon? It hasn't been referred to us in terms of the ATC, but the team are ready to do the presentation. So there's two routes to take. We take the presentation now, and when the referral is done, we just put it formal before the committee for adoption, or we wait until the referral comes sometime in future, which I don't know the date of. I put it to the committee.
Yeah, Chair, I don't think there is a need really to worry about it now, because in any way it's not a lengthy thing. We can just wait till it's referred, and then the day that we meet, then we can deal with the particular matter. Unless if it is to do with financial prudence from Treasury, avoiding to come back, you know, then it will be another issue. But in terms of time, I don't think that it is a problem, except that we'll just simply put in the card for the horse.
Nations, looking at budgets and expenses, I'm worried about expenses. Chair? I just want to get that I understand you clearly. You want us to leave the presentation now until the formal referral? Or can we do it now? Yeah, I'm worried about that. Yes?
Jay, sorry. It's just a protocol to that treaty with Oman, and it merely empowers us to withhold the dividend tax on dividends paid to non-resident shareholders, as we've done in a number of other protocols. And it's got one other change to that particular double taxation agreement. It's a couple of minutes, Chair, really.
Yes, Honourable Lees.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very hesitant about sending officials away and calling them back for a couple of minutes. Their presentation is not part of the formal decision making of this committee. It's the lead up to the decision, and whether we get the presentation now or after the referral, I can't see any legal problem with that. But for us to say go away and then come back in August for a 5-minute presentation from Pretoria, I think would be irresponsible. If I'm reading the situation correctly.
Yeah, Chair. The one problem is that we have to record minutes of what we are doing, and then definitely record that we have received the presentation
saying in terms of procedure, obviously we can't deal with something that is not yet been referred to us. But also, I think that there would not be anything perhaps wrong, even if at the time it is referred, we don't necessarily call back delegation from the national department from Pretoria, so to say. We can still get somebody from here because there are people from Treasury here in this building just to come and present it, and then we adopt it because we have gone through it already now, we understand. But unfortunately, if we are to deal with it now and then when it is referred, we deal with it, even our reporting will be like skewed that we dealt with it at some point and all those things.
In terms of the procedures, it's not correct to deal with it now.
Yes.
In terms of parliamentary procedures, I don't want to let this committee run into that trouble. Unfortunately, it's a situation. And we will have to speak to the people dealing with the referrals. Why wasn't this part of the package coming to this committee? And that I can't explain. So we're going to park this one for the time being. It will then be dealt with in the third term. So, Mr. Van der Merwe, thank you very much for your presentation. The rest of your team, yes, sir.
Sorry, Chair, I was busy with papers. Was there also a resolution on the multilateral? The last one I did.
It's not been referred to this committee. Welcome to stay, but you are released if you want to go. You're still in time to kiss the street. minutes with referring to the meeting of the 30th of May. Albert Monsisi, you want to address the committee? Okay. Honourable members, minutes of the 30th of May. It was a briefing on the annual reports of the supervisors of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency and the Reserve Bank, etc., as well as dealing with outstanding committee minutes. I put to you page 1. On page 2, I've got a few corrections in terms of spelling. Page 2, the second sentence at the top was to receive briefings, S after the G, from the supervisors. Or receive a briefing, but can't stand as is. And then the second point, second sentence, Mrs. O. Mashani, and so the sentence go on. Presented supervisors of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency 2010-2011 annual report. I don't know if it's correct to say on there. Just delete that, thank you. Point 3, briefing by the combined annual report. Combined, there's something missing there. I don't know. Briefing by the combined. Are you happy with that sentence? Something is wrong, but I can't pinpoint it. Yes, sir, Honorable Lees, can you please listen here?
Perhaps it should read briefing by the combined supervisors of the cooperative banks and leave out the annual report of the.
Honorable members, page 3. I put a set of minutes to the committee for adoption.
Page 3, Chair, I think.
Page 3, Honorable. There's a meeting
I
next to me.
I think that passed that to the next meeting, and that paragraph that follows must be deleted.
Sorry, I can't hear, say again.
Delete the part that starts with the next meeting was scheduled as follows, and that paragraph that follows, delete. It should only be that sentence that ends with 12:10, full stop. Then you delete the rest.
Okay.
Thank you.
With these corrections, can we get...
And I move, Chair.
Honorable Charlie moves for adoption, and seconder. Thank you, Honorable Lees. That covers the minutes. Honorable members, this brings us... This is our last meeting for this term. Thank you for your cooperation this year until now. It's a pleasure to work with you. We have to engage again with the ministerial task team led by the Minister of Finance with regard to the intervention in terms of Section 100B in the 5 departments, provincial departments of Limpopo. I liaised with the minister. He's on his way back tonight from Mexico to look at his diary. And I requested that we do it as soon as possible, the end of July, beginning of August, depending on the availability of all those ministers. And at the previous meeting, we had 8 ministers in front of the committee, appearing before the committee. So I just want to sensitize, we have to, in terms of the constitution, review the intervention regularly, and I think the sooner we do it, the better. Also referring to the action plans that was adopted by the task team and to be implemented. Honorable members, that brings us to the end of this meeting. I've just received a message. Plenary is 10:30 tomorrow and not 2 o'clock, so it's a morning plenary. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you, Nico, for also be present. And to the staff arranging the meeting. Meeting adjourned. Lunch? I don't know. Ask Mr. Hinto.